Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, and co-hosting with me today is Angelica Ortiz. You do lots of different things. Chiropractor in training, almost there. New doula. And you're the editor of the Informed Pregnancy blog.
Mm-hmm.
And a social media guru.
Yeah.
All the above. Yeah, that is me. Thanks for being here. And today's guest is Dr. Emiliano Chavira.
Hello.
He is an OBGYN and MFM. What's an MFM?
That stands for maternal fetal medicine. So it's like an OBGYN, but I don't do much GYN. Pretty much it's all pregnancy. And
you're all OB all the time?
All OB all the time.
Wow.
It tends to be pregnancies that have some kind of special issue. And that could be the mom. It could be the baby. So it tend to be something other than a, you know, normal uncomplicated pregnancy.
Is what people would refer to as high risk?
Yeah, but
you don't like the term.
I hate the term.
Okay.
What do you prefer?
You know, I like maternal fetal medicine. People also refer to us as perinatologists, although most people are very confused by that term and they don't know what it is.
It is confusing.
When I say high risk pregnancy, then they kind of, the light bulb clicks and they sort of know what I'm talking about. But I just don't like it because it's kind of a scary sounding term and it's very poorly defined. And high risk, you know, that word high, it's kind of subjective. Like what exactly is high?
That's a negative connotation.
Yeah, very much so. So I don't like that term, but I...
Pregnancies that would benefit from some more closer monitoring?
Maybe.
.com?
Maybe. Or maybe just a little bit of conversation to start off with.
That sounds fair. And to become an MFM, so first you do OBGYN training and then you specialize?
Yeah, well, okay. So first is kindergarten and then, just kidding. Yeah, so after medical school, you do your OBGYN residency. And that's 4 years. And at that point, you could stop and practice as a general OB-GYN, or you continue training, which is what I did. And you do what's called a fellowship in maternal fetal medicine. That was another 3 years. And it's really heavily focused on a lot of ultrasound. So we're ultrasounding the babies. And then also, you know, taking care of moms with special medical conditions and so forth. And
is it a lot of ultrasound to look for things that are beyond the average, or is it a more advanced ultrasound? Meaning, is it the machine that's more advanced, or is it your observations?
Well, it's both. I mean, we, you know, the ultrasound technology keeps advancing, and they keep inventing new stuff. And so,
I'm waiting for the iPhone app.
We have to, right? Oh, that would be so great.
Yeah.
But also, we have you know, special skills above and beyond what a general OB-GYN might do, because a lot of them do ultrasound, and also we above and beyond what a radiologist might do, because radiologists also do a lot of OB ultrasound.
So it's.
But I would say when it comes to pregnancy, we're the ultimate specialists in pregnancy ultrasound.
Neat. Today we have a topic that was requested by a listener, an Informed Pregnancy Podcast listener, and the topic is preterm labor. So it sounds like when there is a preterm labor concern or issue, is that one of the things that falls under perinatology?
That's kind of a yes and no. I mean, I think preterm labor, it's a very common obstetric complication. Roughly about 10% of babies will be born before 37 weeks. That's the definition of preterm.
So 37 weeks is term?
37 is term.
Okay. And there are various stages to term.
Yeah, there's some new definitions about that. So now between 37 and 39 weeks is called early term. And 39 to 41 is considered full term. And then 41 to 42 is late term.
Oh, goodness. Not and late term.
God beyond forbid. 42 is post term.
Look at all those terms.
Yeah.
Awesome. Terminology.
So, yeah, anything less than 37 weeks is technically defined as preterm. What was I saying? That's about 10% of pregnancies. And it's kind of, that's sort of, I think, a kind of bread and butter obstetric issue that a general OB-GYN is perfectly well equipped to, you know, to take care of and handle. But, It is becoming very common for OBs to call an MFM in, so sometimes they involve us, but there's not really anything special we would do above and beyond what a general OB-GYN might do.
You know, you're I sort of feel compelled to say this to the audience. You're an interesting mix because you are an OBGYN medical doctor. You're a MFM, which we already described what that is. But you're also sort of very holistically minded.
Yeah, that's true.
You don't come across very often. I, in general, find MFMs to go the other way, meaning to some degree your client is the baby. And you don't really have so much access to the baby, and I sort of feel like MFMs like to get the baby out no matter what. But you're not in that boat per se. Must be lonely.
I mean, you're right. I am sort of a unique practitioner, I guess. A lot of MFMs really move into consultation only type of practice, and they don't do deliveries. Mm-hmm. So that's not universally true, but it's very common. But I've just always loved the labor and delivery, and I've just kept it up and kept my feet in that realm. And something happened to me in the last 5-10 years where I've kind of gravitated more and more toward the philosophy of midwives. So I almost, when I get called an OB these days, I almost don't relate to that term anymore. I kind of feel almost more like a midwife / MFM.
You're a maternal fetal midwife.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. It's a new term, new category.
Good acronym.
So preterm labor then is defined as labor that starts before 37 weeks. And I presume that the further along that you are closer to 37 weeks, the less of an issue that becomes.
Totally correct, yeah.
So what's the earliest that somebody can deliver and still expect the baby to be okay?
So there is not a there's not a magic line where you cross that I would make that statement, you can expect the baby to be okay. It's more of a continuum.
Okay.
So one kind of line that has existed for the last few decades is about 24 weeks, and we call this the line of viability, mm-hmm. meaning if you deliver less earlier than the 24 weeks, there's kind of no real hope. The most skilled neonatologist in the highest level NICU is not going to be able to save that baby. And this 24-week line, it's a very blurry line. And there is, you know, some chance of survival in the 23-week window. So it's not a hard and fast line. But let's just say for simplicity's sake, 24 weeks is the line of viability. There's probably something like a 50-50 chance of survival if you deliver it 24 weeks. And that's, you know, plus minus.
Mm-hmm. Well, even the number of weeks is not an exact science.
True. Yeah. So. It's an estimate, and depending on how early you started in their pregnancy, that estimate varies in precision, right? Mm-hmm. But so every week that passes by, the chance that the baby's going to make it goes up, and it goes up pretty quickly. So by the time we hit 28 weeks, we're pretty well over 90% survival. So that's probably the very highest risk window in which to deliver is that like 24 to 28 week month. And if you stretch the pregnancy out for one additional month and you get out to like 32, 34 weeks, you know, we still prefer a baby not to be born at that time, but the survival really is over 99%. And you know, the large bulk of those babies do really well.
Mm-hmm. Good. I have so many questions, and some of them are from this listener, but also my own questions. So obviously, let's start with risk factors for preterm labor. Mm-hmm. Are there people who are greater at risk for preterm labor? And if so, what are those factors?
Yeah, there's different types of preterm births, and so we break them up into a couple of categories. So one is what's called iatrogenic. So that word means it's caused by the physicians, meaning you weren't really in labor, you were not going to deliver the baby, but we have decided to deliver the baby early because something going on. So for example, one reason might be the baby's really not growing well. Mm-hmm. And is really struggling, and that there's certain factors that make you think this baby, if we leave it in utero, may pass away at some point. So we make the decision to go ahead and do the delivery. Or let's say the mom is developing preeclampsia, which is a condition where she's starting to get sick from the pregnancy, blood pressure's going up really high. And there can be other things that go along with that, you know, like kidney failure and swelling of the liver and all these things. So a mild case of preeclampsia, we might follow that mom very closely and see how far we could stretch out the pregnancy, try to make it to term and deliver. But if the preeclampsia starts becoming very severe, this is now turning into a life-threatening situation.
More so, for the mother than the baby,
but well, obviously, for both, because if, you know,
if the mother goes, the baby goes.
Exactly, yeah. So that might be another reason for an iatrogenic preterm birth. Like, it's not that she's in labor, but we're saying it's time to cut this pregnancy short and deliver the baby. So that's kind of one category. And, you know, moms that – there are certain moms that have a slightly elevated risk of that compared to the general population. Like, in general, we see preeclampsia maybe like 5 to 10% of pregnancies, something in that neighborhood. So moms, as they get older, the incidence starts to climb. Moms that are very young, like teenagers, for some reason have a higher risk of preeclampsia. First birth is a risk factor, or first pregnancy, I should say.
For preeclampsia?
For preeclampsia.
So that means that people who have it are not necessarily likely to have it again in a subsequent pregnancy?
If you're having your second pregnancy without a history of preeclampsia, you are less likely to get it than women who are having their first pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
If you've had it before, that actually is a risk factor.
For having it again.
Okay. Although, you know, this gets back to this high-risk pregnancy issue. If you've had it before, you're still more likely to not get it in your next pregnancy. In other words, like we said, there's a baseline 5 to 10% risk, right? So let's say your risk is double that, 10 to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
That makes you a high-risk person. But if you flip that around, you've got an
80-90%
chance of not getting it. So the most likely thing is that you're not going to get it.
Right. Even if you've had it before.
Right. And then women with certain medical complications have a higher chance of getting preeclampsia. So things like hypertension, maybe diabetes, lupus, kidney disease is a pretty powerful risk factor for getting preeclampsia. So there's various things.
What are the signs of it that you would notice at home?
So a lot of moms will get preeclampsia and have no symptoms. So that's why it is important to go to the prenatal visits. And one of the things they check for is preeclampsia. They check your blood pressure and they check your urine to see if you're starting to leak protein into the urine. Some moms will get symptoms, and there's kind of like four things. So one is a persistent headache that won't go away. Then you might get visual symptoms. So these could be things like you're seeing spots, you're seeing flashing lights, and not a quick thing where like you stand up from the sofa and you get woozy for a moment, but like an ongoing persistent kind of symptom. From liver swelling, you might have some pain or nausea or discomfort in the upper abdomen. And then some women will notice, sudden onset of swelling, and not so much in the feet because that can be really normal in pregnancy, but more like hands and face, which is a little bit less typical in pregnancy. So all of a sudden symptoms like that develop. Either you let your doctor know or you just swing by the hospital where you're planning to deliver for them to check you out.
I remember seeing someone, the worst case that I remember seeing just in the office, I'm like, this doesn't look right, but she looked very ill.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't preeclampsia, it was eclampsia. She just,
what?
She looked very flu-like. She just looked extremely uncomfortable. And then, you know, I think they actually, if I remember correctly, they just went right to cesarean. She was close to the end, but not maybe 37 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the one category of iatrogenic preterm birth. The other category is what we refer to as spontaneous preterm labor, which probably is mostly what you're talking about today, where you know, you're kind of planning and hoping everything's going to be normal, and one day before it's time, you start contracting and you go into labor and deliver the baby, and it happens sort of through two mechanisms. One is you start contracting and your cervix dilates and you go into labor. The other is the bag of water may pop you know, before anything else has happened. That's sort of the first sign or symptom, is you're leaking amniotic fluid.
I have questions about both of those.
Sure.
Because it's fairly normal to have some contractions during mm-hmm. pregnancy mm-hmm. that are not labor. How do you differentiate those contractions that are Braxton Hicks-like contractions versus maybe pre-term this is labor, right? Even though I'm not at 37 weeks?
Yeah. That's a great question. So most of the time, that's a pretty easy distinction. Braxton Hicks will not be regular. You may have a handful during the day, or you may have sort of a brief run of them for an hour or so, and then they kind of calm down and disappear. So they're not regular, and they're not accelerating and escalating. So if you get into a pattern where the contractions are starting to come one after the other, like they're every 10 minutes and they're every 7 and they're every 5 and they're getting stronger and stronger and stronger, that's more concerning that might be preterm labor.
Yeah.
Ultimately, there's no way that you can count them out and distinguish between Braxton Hicks and true preterm labor. The ultimate way you're going to make this distinction is if the cervix is dilating or not.
Mm-hmm.
So if the cervix is not dilating, then you're not in labor.
And my iPhone can't tell me that either yet.
Right.
So
they're gonna have to invent some kind of adapter before we can do that.
I did see that there is. Did you see the monitor, the dilation monitor?
No.
It's like two electrodes that are placed in near the cervix, and it just like Bluetooths out with.
No,
the
but I did see they've invented a new kind of speculum. That's like a little mini camera, so that you don't have to use the big metal speculum device. You kind of insert this tube, and it's used for a different purpose. They're trying to visualize the cervix, looking for like cervical dysplasia and these precursors to cervical cancer. But just because you brought it up, it made me think you could actually look at the cervix and see what's happening.
Wow, the technology is coming. I bet Angelica is going to develop
innovation.
Cool stuff like that. It's the new generation coming up.
It is.
Okay, so you were saying the difference between Braxton Hicks and what might be labor contractions.
Yeah,
and
so you know, based on their pattern, you can't really tell 100%. You would if it seems like they're becoming regular and stronger, then I think it's more. It may be that you're actually in preterm labor, and that's the time you would go see whoever your provider is. You know, whether that's, you know, midwife or family practice or OB or whoever it is. And probably they're going to check your cervix and use that to distinguish whether you're really in labor or not.
On the second half of this podcast, because I have so many questions I want to jump to, but I sort of want to make sense of it all for listeners, I'm going to talk about the what do we do in these scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But for now, the other thing you said is if your water breaks, and there are two, it's not always 100% clear. Did I just pee a little bit? Because sometimes the water breaks with a big gush, and sometimes there's little trickles.
Absolutely.
So any way to sort of tell, is that my water?
Well, there really isn't. A lot of times during pregnancy, there'll be a little bit of a discharge kind of on a daily basis that can be totally normal. So if you don't have any particular discomfort or like itching or burning or something's bothering you and there's not a real intense odor, that's probably a normal discharge of pregnancy. So if it's been going on the whole pregnancy and there's kind of nothing different about it today, I think so. Most women, I think, will get used to that. They have a sense of what their discharge is.
Does that normal discharge tend to have a color or a description that goes with it?
It can be either clear or whitish,
mm-hmm.
or maybe even a real, real faint yellow.
Okay.
It differs for every woman, right?
I think it's different for every woman. You know, there was one OB who. Now, this is in non-pregnancy. He did a study on how do we characterize normal, healthy vaginal discharge. And he got 6 GYN textbooks and found that the description of the vaginal discharge was different in every single textbook.
Wow.
So I think that kind of makes the point that you just said, that
everyone's
different. There is some normal variation.
I imagine even within a pregnancy, she can have
But just noticing variations. What's normal for you and being able to relate that to how you are in pregnancy.
So I think, if you kind of have a sense of what your the vaginal discharge has been like, and then all of a sudden there's something more or different that might need to be investigated. Mm-hmm. Or if you've been dry the whole pregnancy and then all of a sudden you're having a little bit of discharge, that could be a lot of things. It could just be vaginal discharge. It could be cervical mucus. Maybe if you've had intercourse recently, it could be sperm coming out. It could be urine, or it could be that the bag has sprung a little leak and you're leaking amniotic fluid. There's not really a way at this point that I think you can tell at home. That probably just requires an evaluation. There's a few tests that they do to distinguish amniotic fluid from other fluids.
What kind of tests? Oh, you mean like chemical tests?
Mm-hmm.
Or getting samples?
Yeah, so historically, there were three things. One is you look to see if there's actually fluid draining out of the cervix and there's a little pool of fluid accumulating in the vagina. Then there's a pH test, so they have a little stick. And basically, it's called nitrazine.
Okay.
And based on the pH of the amniotic fluid, it turns from yellow to blue, and that's a clue.
Even if you're a van girl? Just kidding.
Okay. Yeah, then... In those cases, it turns leopard print.
I see. Yeah.
So then one final test is they smear a little bit of fluid on a slide, and when it dries, these crystal forms.
The crystals from
the amniotic it's actually really beautiful.
It's cool to look at.
You look for that under the microscope. Nowadays, they've invented some more advanced chemical tests based on, you know, certain substances that you would not expect to be in the vagina if the membranes hadn't ruptured. Mm-hmm. So there are some advances.
But they're not? We can't do them at home?
Not yet.
Okay.
They may come.
Sure. Yeah. So those are the two signs that you might be experiencing preterm labor. If your contractions are picking up sort of into a labor pattern, or if your water might have broken. And they don't always happen at the same time.
Yeah. And, you know, one other... More kind of subtle thing is
if the baby comes
bleeding.
Out. Oh,
yeah. No, baby coming out would be.
It's a sign.
Yeah, that's definitely a sign. Yeah.
What kind of bleeding?
Bleeding or spotting? Yeah, I was just about to.
So that can vary, right? It can be anything from you notice a little bit of spotting when you wipe, all the way up to, you know, bleeding like a period or heavier, and that can come from different sources. It could come from the cervix dilating. Sometimes you bleed a little bit as the cervix is opening. It could be from a little bit of separation between the placenta and the uterus. You know, it kind of just peels off the uterine wall a little bit. So it can come from different sources. And that doesn't always mean you're in labor, but that could be another potential early sign. So
if you see bleeding, is it always something to go check out?
I think it's probably always something to communicate with your provider, because you just got to put it in context of everything else. You know, your other symptoms, what gestational age you are, what your prior OB history is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, bleeding in pregnancy is tremendously common. We have women telling us about this all the time, and the large majority of the time, everything is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say
it's reassuring.
Yeah. So it's not a thing to freak out about, but I think it's something you always want to just run by your provider.
Are there things that put a woman at greater risk for these types of preterm labor, for starting contractions or for her water breaking?
We are learning a lot about that, and I don't think we have a good answer to that question yet. There's, you know, one category of things is organisms that live in your body and different bacteria. And it's been known for a long time that some women who have preterm birth, it's related to bacteria that are in the amniotic fluid or in the uterine cavity or environment. And the earlier the preterm birth, the more likely you are to find bacteria in the amniotic fluid. So it's always known that this is one of the causes.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been known. But I think our understanding about this is beginning to advance, because we used to have very simplistic ideas about the sterility of the intrauterine environment. And now we're realizing there's organisms everywhere. There are organisms in the placenta, and the population of bacteria or bugs, we refer to this as the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, there are studies looking at the microbiome in the mouth, the microbiome that lives in the vagina, the microbiome
the
that
gut.
Lives in the gut,
yes.
the microbiome that lives in the placenta.
Hmm.
We're getting more and more clues about how these population of organisms may feed into this preterm birth pathway. But we're not at a place where I think we get it all. We're kind of learning about this. And unfortunately, there's not a test that you can do where you go, to
Swan.
Your provider's office and they do the test and they say, yes, you are at risk for a preterm birth or going to have one. We don't really have that yet. So the only thing we really have at this point are things like if your cervix is checked with ultrasound early in the pregnancy, somewhere between 20 to 24 weeks, and is found to be short,
mm-hmm.
that's a risk factor for preterm birth.
What does that mean, short?
So the cervix is like a little tube, right? And you can measure from the inside, which is leading into the uterus, to the outside, which is leading into the vagina.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it with a vaginal ultrasound. That's much more accurate than doing an ultrasound where you're holding the probe on the belly. You can measure it that way, but it really is very inaccurate to measure that way. So you do it with a vaginal ultrasound. And when you measure how long it is, on average, at 20 to 24 weeks, it's probably going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 centimeters. If it's less than 2.5, that's generally the definition of a short cervix.
Mm-hmm.
So that does not mean you're going to have a preterm birth. Many women with a cervix less than 2.5 and even quite shorter than that will go on to have a full-term birth. But your chances of having a preterm birth is higher than that woman who's got like a 4 centimeter cervical length.
So, I mean, you're saying long or short, but is it thickness?
Or height? Length?
What creates the length of the cervix?
So I think this is usually the term that people use to refer to this as effacement.
Okay.
Okay. Let me think of an analogy. Let's say, imagine you're putting on a turtleneck sweater.
Okay.
Okay. So as you put your head into the sweater, before your head has gone through the neck,
mm-hmm.
the turtleneck part is long. So that's like a long cervix.
Okay.
Right? Now, as you start to push your head through the turtleneck, you can almost imagine that's like the baby's head going through the mom's cervix.
Okay.
So the lower part of the turtleneck starts to stretch over your head.
Yes.
And then the turtle part of the turtleneck is getting shorter and shorter.
I see what you're saying. So as the head pushes down into it, it will short.
Yeah. Now, I don't think it happens because the fetal head is pushing through it.
But that's your analogy.
But that's the analogy, okay. Right? So you can sort of visually imagine the cervix getting shorter.
I'm going to envision cervical length every time I put a turtleneck on now. All
right. This is really interesting and I think helpful information. We're going to take a quick commercial break and be right back with Dr. Emiliano Chivira. I understand the mental demands of motherhood. I see it every day in my practice. That's why I'm excited about Needed's new cognitive support. Unlike other supplements, it's specifically formulated with postpartum and breastfeeding moms in mind, using safe and effective ingredients. This means that moms can get the brain boost they deserve without compromising safety. Plus, it includes clinically studied ingredients, proven to support focus and memory. Hurry and get your cognitive support from Needed before you forget. Visit thisisneeded.com and use your code Berlin to get 20% off your initial order. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby. Not even diaper rash. Welcome back to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin. Today's co-host, Angelica Ortiz, and our guest, maternal fetal midwife, Dr. Emiliano Javier. Welcome back.
I love it.
What about lifestyle habits? We're talking about preterm labor. Mm-hmm. Do lifestyle things lead to, you know, like smoking or drinking or drugs? They always tell you not to
or
do
stress.
It.
Or stress.
Mm. Great. Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that have been shown to influence preterm birth. So smoking, I think, is one. And the mechanism through which that happens really is abruption. The chance of placental separation from the uterine wall is higher in women who smoke during pregnancy. And there's a dose response relationship, meaning the more you smoke, the higher the chance of
the
something
more
like
likely
is
your
happen.
Placenta
yeah.
is going to pull
so
off.
So even if you can't quit completely smoking, even cutting down is a helpful. Value.
Smoking yeah. tobacco?
Yeah, I mean, primarily I'm talking about tobacco. I mean, people are talking a lot about marijuana these days.
Right.
And I mean, I think the issue with smoking is that whatever chemical you're specifically talking about, whether it be tobacco or marijuana, mm-hmm. that's only one thing that's in the smoke. So all the combustion products, you're really breathing in hundreds of different chemicals.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it matters so much what you're smoking as much as the fact that you're smoking. And just, yeah, breathing
Although
a bunch
vaping,
of stuff into
vaping
your lungs.
Vaping the bubble gum.
Yeah.
people do.
Yeah. So smoking certainly, and, you know, there's certain drugs that are associated with preterm birth. So these would be like things like cocaine, methamphetamines, and it might be through a similar mechanism through,
Placental abruption.
I think stress has been associated with preterm birth, and I'm always really a little bit reluctant to say that because stress is part of life, and everybody's stressed, and
right.
now you're like, oh my God, now I'm stressed, and my stress is hurting the baby. I think it is valuable to try to figure out how to manage stress a little bit, and it's good for pregnancy and it's good for the baby and it's good for life in general.
Definitely.
I think disordered sleep is an issue that we have not paid a lot of attention to, but is probably important. You know, there's some hormonal cycles that happen in sync with the diurnal cycle, that, you know, day and night. And when you don't sleep well, it sort of messes these things up, and it causes actually a lot of health problems. It can cause weight gain, and it can cause hypertension, high blood pressure, and some studies coming out now that it can have impacts on pregnancy, like gestational diabetes and potentially, you know, preterm birth. So healthy sleep is going to be important.
What about nutritional deficiencies?
Yeah.
Good question.
Well, even before you get to specific nutritional deficiencies, skipping breakfast has been shown to be a risk factor for preterm birth. So it's very important to have, your well-balanced diet and eating meals regularly. For a pregnant woman to spend a very prolonged period without a meal is generally something to be avoided. Now, whether there are any specific nutritional deficiencies that put you at risk for preterm birth, I'm not sure about that. Have you?
No, I was just curious, if someone like didn't know they were pregnant, some women don't know until like even the second trimester, like what if they weren't taking their prenatal vitamins
or eating
breakfast. I skip breakfast all the time.
Yeah, I never skip breakfast. But anyway, what about, you mentioned gestational diabetes, and I know the OBs that we work with that really like to have babies out early when mom has gestational diabetes or mm-hmm. diabetes in general, and also hypertension, which also you mentioned. So it almost seems like those two are risk factors for preterm labor, but also for some reason we want to get them out early.
Well, when you say early, not preterm.
No, 39 weeks.
But right. Yeah, so full term, 39 weeks. And that's just because in all pregnancies, in the very last weeks of pregnancy, there's a very small risk, and I emphasize very small risk, of some really serious complications, the worst of which probably being is, you know, just the baby passing away suddenly in utero. Mm-hmm. So that is something that it doesn't happen often, but when it does, obviously it's tremendously devastating and, sure, you know, life-altering. If you have hypertension or diabetes, the chance of something like that happening in your pregnancy is a little bit higher. And this gets back again to our discussion of high risk. So let's say in the population in general, the risk of fetal demise at term is maybe like a couple per thousand. So I've seen various studies in diabetes trying to quantify how much higher the risk is, and maybe it's something like three times higher. So let's say we're talking about six women out of 1,000 will, you know, suffer a complication like this. So it's not that. So it's still, most women are not going to, you know, have something horrible like that happen during their pregnancy. But right, on that basis, that's the rationale for, you know, at 39 weeks, the baby's good and well mature, and let's just go ahead and
induce,
deliver now.
Yeah, is that why so many people are like scared to pass the 40-week mark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I you know, most people, and this is, includes even within the birth world, people who are taking care of pregnant women, this could be the physicians, it could be the labor and delivery nurses, they don't necessarily know these numbers.
Right.
They just sort of know the concept that there's some kind of higher risk. And I think sometimes internally they just may feel that the risk is much, much higher than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And then they personally have a lot of fear about these kind of scenarios, and then they kind of translate that to the patient and characterize staying pregnant beyond 39 or beyond 40 weeks as something really, really dangerous.
Yeah.
When, you know, there is a little risk, but I think it's always important to put it into perspective.
Mm-hmm. You talked about a couple of different causes of preterm labor, one of which was iatrogenic. So if there's a medical reason to put you into, well, to get your baby out early before term, if you have to do that, right, if you have to get a baby out early, are there things that we can do to improve the outcome for the mother and baby before we get the baby out?
Absolutely. And this applies to all preterm births. So in iatrogenic preterm births or spontaneous, if mom comes in, it looks like she's in labor and we think we're delivering, or the membranes have ruptured, we prepare and do a few things that very clearly have been shown to help the baby. So one of these, and probably the most important one, is the administration of steroids. Now these, you always have to explain when you use the word steroids.
Baby comes out all bolted.
Yeah.
Right. Out of buff, baby.
Right.
Wins the Tour de France.
Right.
It breaks your arm wrestling with you. So yeah, this is not, Arnold Schwarzenegger anabolic steroids. That's a term that describes a sort of class of chemicals, and a bunch of chemicals fall in that category, like testosterone is a steroid and estrogen is a steroid. Mm-hmm. These are steroid hormones. So there are the two most commonly used steroids are betamethasone and dexamethasone. And there are now decades worth of studies showing that if your baby is born preemie and if you have received the steroid therapy, your baby does a lot better. It really reduces a lot of the complications that preemie babies can have, and it also increases the likelihood of the baby surviving. And the earlier you deliver, the more important, you know, those steroids are. So that's number one, the steroids.
Are the steroids given?
Yeah.
So they are shots.
Injection to the mother.
They're injections given into the mother intramuscularly. And probably the most common one is betamethasone, and that's two shots given 24 hours apart.
So you would try to prevent the baby's arrival until you're able to do that twice.
Right. If you can.
24 hours.
If it's safe to do so. And in most circumstances it is. And then the other one is dexamethasone, which is four shots every 12 hours. So basically it's a couple days worth of
shots. What's the difference between them?
I think there are minor differences, but I think there's a little more data with the betamethasone, and in my experience, it's just a lot more commonly used.
If the water breaks and you're in that risky period of like 24 to 28 weeks, or even if you're at 28 weeks, does that mean the baby has to come out now? Are there things that you can do to sustain that pregnancy safely and give more time for growth and development?
Great question. So you're playing a balancing game in that situation, because ideally you would like the baby to stay in utero for as long as possible prior to birth.
Right.
And it is very clear that, you know, the farther you go, we talked about this, the farther you go in pregnancy, the better the outcomes are going to be for the baby. On the other hand, the bag of water, when it's intact, really provides a lot of protection to the baby, particularly against infections.
Yeah.
So once the bag of water has broken, this pregnancy is a lot more vulnerable to infection. And so you're really doing this dance of the first answer to your question is no, the baby does not have to deliver immediately. We still do try to keep the mom pregnant for as long as safely possible. But you're really watching very, very closely for any hint of infection. And when that happens, then it's time to deliver.
What are the signs of infection?
The monitoring happens in the hospital.
So she stays in the hospital.
She stays in the hospital. And you're looking for things like fever. That's probably the most important sign. There can be tachycardia, meaning a fast heart rate, and that mm-hmm. could be mother or baby.
Okay, if either one gets a rapid heart rate.
Yeah. Sometimes the mom will develop some uterine tenderness. You know, you're pressing on the uterus and it's just painful. That could be a sign. There are some chemical tests that can be done. You know, some centers, they will actually test the fluid for bacteria or sugar.
Yeah, I was going to say, what type of infection?
Or various things. Usually it's bacterial.
Okay.
And it's usually multiple organisms, not necessarily, you know, one specific. But these specific tests are not, they may happen more in academic centers or certain research centers. And I think in general, it's more clinical features rather than any specific laboratory test.
Would antibiotics be effective?
It's very clearly effective. So there's a lot of research using antibiotics when the bag of water is broken, that it on average helps the pregnancy last longer, and it reduces the incidence of neonatal infections, meaning infection in the baby after the baby's born, or infection in the mom after the pregnancy's over. Mm. So that has been shown to be very helpful. But it's important to clarify that antibiotics have been shown to be helpful if the bag of water is broken.
Right.
If the bag of water is intact, like let's say you show up and mom's contracting and you find her 2 centimeters dilated, antibiotics are not helpful in that scenario.
So let's take that situation, because then you're less worried about infection with the bag of water is intact. But that was the other preterm labor
symptoms.
Mechanism that you mentioned is contractions can start, the cervix
right.
can shorten. Are there things that you can do then to sort of hold things off longer?
There are a whole bunch of medications that kind of suppress contractions and they calm the contractions down. But there are literally hundreds of studies looking at these medications. And overall, if you look at the bulk of this literature, what it shows is we do not have the ability to stop or slow preterm birth in any significant kind of way.
Really?
At the most, we could get 48 hours.
But that could give you enough time to give the steroids.
Yeah. So it could be worthwhile. But, in my mind, I think the basic truth is if a mom is contracting but she's not in labor,
mm-hmm.
you can suppress those contractions and it sort of makes you feel like you're doing something. But she was never really in – if she does not deliver, she probably was just never in labor in the first place and was having Braxton-Hicks contractions.
Uh-huh.
If she is in labor, there's really
nothing
we can do to stop it. So what we can do are all these things to benefit the baby in the event that the preterm birth does happen. So the steroids is one. We talked about antibiotics if
the water's
broken. There is one reason for antibiotics with the bag of water is intact, and that depends on a bacteria called GBS. Mm-hmm. So that's a normal, natural bacteria that lives in the body. It's not an infection. Some moms have it, some moms don't.
And some
same is true of dads, but we're not testing
dads. Yeah, we don't care about dads. Some pregnancies have it and some pregnancies don't.
Some pregnancies have it, yeah. And you could have it at the beginning of the pregnancy and not at the end of the pregnancy or vice versa. So really, when we do a GBS test, we really only consider that valid for about 5 weeks. But if you are having a preterm birth and we don't know if you're GBS positive or not, we actually do give antibiotics when you are in labor to protect the baby against GBS.
Oh, so in the preterm labor, you haven't had your test yet.
Yeah.
Because it's normally tested closer to the end.
Yeah. Yeah, between 35, 37 weeks.
So if at 34 weeks you go into labor,
but sometimes if a mom comes into the hospital and we're worried that this is preterm labor, very often we're supposed to do a GBS test. Mm-hmm. So then
how long does it take?
They have some rapid tests now, but in general, it's about a day or two.
And are you testing through blood or how are you?
This is a vaginal swab.
Vaginal swab.
Yeah. So if it turns out that you're GBS negative, then you would not need those antibiotics in labor, even if you're having a preterm birth.
Mm-hmm. What are the consequences of not giving the antibiotics if a woman does have GBS?
Yeah, you guys ask such good questions. Okay, in women who are colonized with GBS, which is maybe about 25-30% of women.
Interestingly, you said colonized but not infection.
Yeah, because it's not an infection. You know, I'm always very careful to have this clarify that. Yeah, because you start talking about this bacteria and then moms get all worried, like, where did I catch this? And, well, from life.
Yeah, from your colon.
So, we talked about earlier the microbiome, right? There's just bajillions of organisms living all throughout your body. So there's just one of those things. And really, nobody cares too much about GBS when you're not pregnant. The only reason we really care in pregnancy is because babies who are born to GBS positive moms can pick it up and get very sick from it. It's about a 2% infection rate.
2%.
So let's say if you have the GBS moms and you don't treat any of them, you'd see a GBS infection in about 2% of the babies.
2 out of 100 babies.
But so that's good because it's not a super high number, but it can be a very devastating.
Yeah, what kind of sickness?
Condition. I mean, you can die from that, especially if you're a little preemie baby. So you can get pneumonia, you can get meningitis, it depends on where it gets into
the
system.
Is there not a way to, since it's a colonization vaginally, is there not a way to eliminate that colony without killing all of the bacteria in both mother and baby's bloodstream? Because you're talking about IV antibiotics.
Right. Yeah, that's the problem with one of the problems with antibiotics is the organism that you're interested in is not the only one you
kill.
And we're increasingly understanding that all the other organisms that are there have a very important role, and you need them to be healthy, and it's bad to get rid of everything. And then sometimes you get secondary infections from disturbing the balance, and like you can get something that's maybe more minor, like a yeast infection, all the way up to something that is really devastating and horrible, like a C. difficile and colitis. So you can
C. diff.
C. diff. And there are
C. diff sounds like a rapper.
Clostridium.
I think it is a rapper. I have his first album. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh. Does he rap about it?
So, yeah, it would be ideal if we could just hit the bacteria of interest. And there is an issue of choosing antibiotics well, because there are some that are narrower spectrum that just kind of target a little more specifically what you're after, and some are broader spectrum. And I think so one of the things we should be doing is for GBS just using penicillin, because it's much more narrower spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I think it causes less disruption. But what I have found is very commonly people will use ampicillin, mm-hmm. which is more – it's a broader spectrum and it has more issues with resistance.
What about people who use garlic? I'm not kidding. They
the
insert – no, cloves. Cloves of garlic vaginally just to – because it's so antimicrobial.
Yeah. I think that in medicine, we need to become more open-minded, moving into the future about alternatives besides the medicines that we have historically used. Because we're on the one hand, these antibiotics have saved a lot of lives. Mm-hmm. And we must be incredibly grateful for the existence of these antibiotics. But on the other hand, everything that we use has the flip side. And there are the complications and there are the side effects. And the other problem we're running into is having so much resistance. The day may come where we've got bugs that we can't treat with antibiotics because there's so much resistance around. So I think we need to start thinking about other alternatives like, you know, nutritional interventions or probiotic interventions or different things. We got to have more than just antibiotics and we really have to minimize the use of antibiotics as much as possible. So I really like your question. However, I don't know any scientific literature about garlic. So how effective it is and how much it works, I just don't know the answer.
I've never heard
that. How
do
you use it? Yeah. When and what's the dose?
I mean, I wish there was more research on it, but nobody's going to make a lot of money selling.
I really think we should.
GBS garlic.
Right, exactly.
I have a few more questions, especially some that were submitted by the listener who asked us to do this topic. First of all, she wrote that she felt her daughter kick. The baby was breech, and then right after that, her water broke. Can babies kick the sac into rupture?
I don't believe so.
You don't think so?
Because first of all, almost all women talk about how vigorously their babies kick to the degree that it's painful and it bothers them. It's very uncomfortable. And, you know, there's this little human in there squirming around. And the farther you go in pregnancy, it just gets stronger and stronger. And we just don't see that causing the bag of water to break. The other thing that is interesting, if sometimes we will intentionally break the bag of water during labor for it could be for different reasons. And so the way you do it is you put your fingers into the vagina, into the cervix. You can feel the bag of waters on your fingertips. Mm-hmm. And then you have this little plastic hook that you insert up into the cervix and you use it to kind of pop a little bit of hole. Yeah. Sometimes it ain't easy.
It's hard to do.
And you really kind of have to dig in there. But that makes me
wonder if sometimes it's too easy. Like, can the sac be thinner and weaker or stronger and healthier?
Right, exactly. So
are there nutritional things you can do to give yourself a healthy, strong
that
sac?
That I don't know about.
Okay.
So in terms of nutrition, I would just say the stuff that we already know about eating healthy, stick to that kind of do it and exercise. But I think there are in utero processes that can happen that kind of degrade or weaken the sac. Mm-hmm. So this could be chronic bleeding that's causing some inflammation and, you know, it's activating some metabolic cascade and enzymes and things that are sort of weakening the bag over the time. There could be inflammation from organisms that are in there or, you know, this quote unquote infection.
So there are probably circumstances. Urinary tract infections?
Well, it's kind of all related because, all these systems are they're kind of in the same neighborhood, right? Yeah. So organisms that are in the intestine can get into the vagina, can get into the bladder. So I think if the bag of waters breaks easily, that means that something was happening to weaken it, and it really is just inevitable in a matter of time.
When somebody's had preterm labor, either because, not iatrogenically, but if her water broke or contraction started.
Natural purposes.
Yeah. Are there any other things? I mean, are there medical things that you do to try to prevent preterm labor from occurring a second time? Even though you said statistically her odds are pretty good.
Absolutely. There's definitely things. And before we move on to that, let me just mention one last intervention, which is IV magnesium.
Oh, yeah.
So when you're preparing for preterm birth, we talked about steroids, we talked about antibiotics. Magnesium is a third thing. So magnesium, and this is given through an IV infusion. They give it to your IV. For some women, it really does not feel good. It kind of makes you flushed and headache, blurry vision. It can be sort of unpleasant, especially the first few minutes where they're loading it. But it was used historically to prevent preterm birth because it's been shown to kind of slow down the contractions a little bit. But again, when you really look at the literature of this, we haven't won that war. We haven't really successfully stopped preterm birth. But somebody noticed that in the pregnancies where there was exposure to magnesium, less of these kids developed cerebral palsy. And on the basis of this observation, several studies have been done in different countries around the world where they actually tested this theory, and they specifically gave moms IV magnesium with the planned purpose of looking at the effect on cerebral palsy. And it has kind of panned out. And it's been shown that that reduces the risk of cerebral palsy in the baby about 30%.
Is cerebral palsy being a risk of preterm labor?
No, cerebral palsy is a condition that the child would have after birth, and it's a movement disorder where you maybe are not able to coordinate your hand movements very well or your legs very well. And you can have a mild version of cerebral palsy where maybe you kind of walk around with a limp. Mm-hmm. Or a more severe version where maybe you need crutches to get around. Or the more severe form, you might even be wheelchair bound. So,
but what is the cause of it?
That's a whole other podcast.
Okay, we'll do another podcast on that.
But
in relation to this, is it because of the preterm labor?
Let's just say that. The earlier you deliver,
the more likely.
That comes with some additional risk of
cerebral palsy. Because I'm just wondering, why don't we give everybody magnesium during labor?
Yeah. So the earlier you deliver, that's one of the things that some kids will have as a consequence of having been born early is cerebral palsy later in life. So the IV magnesium has been shown to cut that risk by about 30%.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a nutritional element.
Yeah. So that's kind of, I think, the bulk of what we do in preparation for a preterm birth. Now, what you just asked me was, preventing the second preterm birth. So... I think it's in general in obstetric circles, the conversation is limited to progesterone. But I think you really want to kind of take a holistic approach and think about a lot of things like, the mental health of the mom and stress and anxiety. Maybe she was in an abusive relationship. What was the nutritional status like? How much weight did she gain in the first pregnancy? Let's look at that in the second pregnancy. So I think really kind of looking at the whole picture is important. But from a medical point of view, those women should have their cervix looked at with ultrasound between 20 and 24 weeks. There's some people who argue that every woman should have her cervix looked at, not just the ones with a prior or preterm birth. So that's kind of an ongoing debate within our country. But
how reliable is the shortened cervix to a correlation with preterm labor?
It's a risk factor.
Okay.
So,
because I just wonder, my sense is if you check everybody at 24 weeks, we're going to have a whole lot more women on bed rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's why everything is a double-edged sword, but nobody should end up on bed rest, which we'll get to that. But you will identify more women with a short cervix, which will create some interventions, will create some anxiety. And you'll have some women who are very stressed out during their pregnancy who they're destined to deliver a term and don't need to go through it. So, I mean, there are downsides. There's always downsides of testing everybody.
It sounds like you're not a fan of bed rest.
Certainly. Yeah. No, I'm absolutely opposed to bed rest.
So if you find a shortened cervix at 24 weeks,
so I used to do bed rest because, I'm a trained OBGYN, and that's what we were trained to do. But this is one of those interventions that is done just because it kind of makes sense. I think there's some things that we have always observed in pregnancy. We've always observed miscarriages. We've always observed preterm births. And I think it creates this kind of sense that pregnancy is sort of a delicate state.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think bed rest is just kind of a logical extension of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was never done because there was a study that proved that if you did bed rest, your chance of successful pregnancy outcome is higher. That study does not exist. And in fact, now that we're more into studies and evidence-based medicine and asking the question, all this stuff we're doing, does it actually work? There was a study that came out a few years ago where they looked at women with shortened cervix. So these are women at increased risk of preterm birth. And they put them into categories depending on what they were told as far as activity.
Hmm.
And so there was a range of restrictions. Some women were put on complete bed rest. Some women were told, well, don't do complete bed rest, but just kind of take it easy. Some women were told, avoid intercourse. And then there were some women that were given no restrictions whatsoever. The women that had the lowest percentage of preterm birth were the women that were given no restrictions whatsoever.
Wow. There's is the sense that they just trusted their instincts, or they just business as usual.
They also have peace of mind.
So that's exactly what the authors of the paper said. So first of all, I think we don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. There's an observation. And so now the question is, well, why is that? And what the authors of this paper said, well, maybe when you put people on bed rest, you create this notion that they're
fragile
and at high risk for delivery. And now they're just intensely stressed. So maybe that was part of it. Another idea that has crossed my mind is maybe when you are immobile, you're no longer exercising the pelvic floor. You know, maybe moving around, it keeps your pelvis strong. And so you lay in bed and everything weakens and, you know, you're more likely to have a preterm birth. That's Who knows?
Also, circulation, because I see very active people put on bed rest for this reason. Mm-hmm. And the circulation just goes from very active to very inactive.
Yeah. And, it's incredibly painful.
Bed rest?
Yeah. If you see women who've been on bed rest for the whole pregnancy, like their back pain, I mean, it's terrible. It's horrible.
I see them.
Totally deconditioned.
That's what happens.
It increases the risk of them getting, you know, blood clots in their legs or lungs. And so, you know, there's no studies out there that shows that it's helpful. There are now some studies suggesting that maybe it's even increases your chance of preterm birth. And then there's all these other harms, not to mention the economic harms, you know, taking somebody off of work. For some families, that is a huge problem. There may be childcare issues. They got some other kids at home. So the American College of OBGYN has actually come out and formally said we should no longer be routinely prescribing bed rest. And yet, how often do I see that happening?
All the time.
Every single day.
Yeah.
But it's just old habits die hard.
Gosh, I have so many more questions and not that much more time.
We need
a part
two.
You're going to have to come back. These are the two questions that I have in my mind that I want to address. One is, you mentioned progesterone as a way to potentially manage or prevent preterm labor in a woman who's already had it, so in her subsequent pregnancies. And then the other one was the cerclage.
Yeah. Okay, so progesterone is given in different ways and in different circumstances. So one way it's given is injected. So this is called 17-hydroxyprogesterone, and you get an injection once a week. And there were studies done on women who had a prior history of preterm birth. You start them somewhere between 16 and 20 weeks, and they get the shot once a week all the way out to 36 weeks. That's the last one, and then they graduate. Mm-hmm. And the studies have shown that it decreases the chance of having a preterm birth by about 30-40%. So these are women who've had a preterm birth before. So just based on your history, you become a candidate. You can automatically have that.
Is this a shot she does at home, or she has to go in and have it done?
That'll depend on the scenario.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's done both ways.
But roughly 20 shots through the pregnancy.
Yeah, so that you would work out, you know, with your care provider.
Does it go into fatty tissue, or what do you like?
You know, it's intramuscular.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like glute.
Mm-hmm. And there have been subsequent studies of starting a little bit later, between 20 and 24 weeks, mm-hmm. that have shown actually that it's helpful. So even if you start late, it's good. If you start too late, like there's studies showing starting after 28 weeks makes no difference.
Oh, really?
At that point, that your destiny is your destiny.
Okay.
So it needs to start at the appropriate time. The other way to give progesterone is vaginally.
Suppositories.
And this is usually done, there are suppositories, there are gels.
Oh, gel.
So this is usually done if you identify somebody with the short cervix. And different studies have used different cutoffs, 1.5 centimeters, 2 centimeters. I think in general, what we're now saying is a community of MFMs. If your cervix is less than 2 centimeters, you're a candidate for vaginal progesterone. It's probably works a little better than the weekly ingested progesterone if you have a short cervix.
Mm-hmm.
So the shots is for women with a prior history of preterm birth, period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The vaginal progesterone is if you have a short cervix with or without a prior history. It could be your first pregnancy. If they happen to find your cervix short.
How often do you get the?
Once a day.
Daily.
It's daily.
Okay. Yeah. Cerclage.
There's three scenarios in which you use that. One is history indicated. So that means you've had a mid-trimester pregnancy loss in the past. Now, this is interesting. It used to be that the studies only show this to be beneficial for women who've lost three pregnancies.
Okay.
The most recent guidelines are saying if you've had one that looks like cervical insufficiency, you're a candidate for Cerclage. So that's based on your history. So if you've had a mid-trimester pregnancy loss, your next pregnancy, you can have a Cerclage placed. Usually it'll be like 12 to 14 weeks.
Okay.
That's a history indicator.
How do you do it?
You usually go to the operating room because you would not be able to tolerate this being done in the office. You get a spinal, so there's a little shot in the spine. It puts you numb from the waist down.
Mm-hmm.
We put your feet up into the stirrups, kind of like when you're getting a pap smear, a speculum into the vagina so you could see the cervix. And then you take a suture, and there's different types of sutures that are used, but you basically stitch around the cervix, and you tie a little knot. So it's, you basically have a string around the cervix, but it's stitched in place.
Like stitching it closed.
Stitches, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Stitching it closed.
And then when do you take it out?
You either take it out toward the end of pregnancy, like maybe in the neighborhood of 36 weeks, if all's going well, or if mom shows up in preterm labor, the Cerclage is not going to keep the baby in there. In fact, it's just going to tear through the cervix.
Mm.
So if mom looks like she's in labor, you're going to remove the Cerclage.
Is it painful to take it out?
The painful thing is the speculum.
It's not the removal of the stitch.
Yeah, so is it painful? Yes. No woman likes to have a speculum placed. And in my experience during pregnancy, it seems to be worse than when you're not pregnant.
More sensitive.
Okay, so that was the history indicated. So exam indicated, what that means is if you're looking at a woman's cervix with vaginal ultrasound and is deemed to be short, meaning less than 2.5 centimeters, and she has a history of a prior preterm birth, that has been shown to be a scenario in which the Cerclage is helpful to the pregnancy. And there's about five studies that have led to this conclusion. So,
oh, wow.
So prior history of preterm birth and your cervix is short, you are a candidate for Cerclage. It's usually not placed anytime after 24 weeks.
Why is
so
that?
That's a long answer.
Okay.
And it's sort of value laden. But that's kind of the current standard that it should be placed prior to 24 weeks.
So you'd measure the cervix earlier?
Right. And we said usually you're checking it somewhere between 20 and 24.
20 and 24. Right? So if you see it at 20 and she has the history.
Yeah. And then the final type of Cerclage is what's called I'm sorry, that was the ultrasound indicated Cerclage. The exam indicated Cerclage means her cervix is actually dilated.
Okay.
You found the cervix dilated. And I'll give you one example. Let's say she comes in at 20 weeks, thinks everything's fine, has had zero symptoms, and shows up for her 20-week ultrasound. You're looking at the baby. They point the ultrasound to the cervix, and whoa, cervix is open. And you find it's dilated. So whether you've had a preterm birth or not, you can have a discussion about having a Cerclage placed in that scenario. In general, if you are found to have your cervix dilated in mid-pregnancy, on average, the duration of that pregnancy is going to be about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously some women will deliver sooner than that. Some women, their pregnancy will last longer than that, but on average about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at multiple studies about Cerclage and what the outcomes are, it seems to be that you get about 7 weeks of pregnancy if you place a Cerclage, if the cervix is open.
Sure.
So it seems that on average, if you place a Cerclage with an open cervix, your pregnancy will last a little bit longer. And again, that's an average. You could place a Cerclage and deliver the next day. We see lots of pregnancies that go well beyond, 7 weeks with the Cerclage. So the 7 weeks is just sort of an average.
Does she feel it after it's
So you
placed?
Don't feel the placement because of the spinal.
Right.
I have some moms that say they don't feel anything, and some just kind of feel a little nagging something, and I wonder if maybe they're feeling the knot down there. Mm-hmm. So there may be some sensation associated with it, but it's usually not anything unbearable or really bad.
Dr. Shabir, thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome. It was fun.
For sharing your expertise and your knowledge with us. We hope to have you back real soon.
On cerebral palsy.
Anytime.
We don't have a myriad of topics.
Yeah.
But also, we're going to bring you over to our sister show on YouTube, The Real Midwives of Los Angeles, which you can find at therealmidwives.com.
Cool. Can't wait.
Thanks for listening to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. Share us with your friends and visit us on informedpregnancy.com.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a whole lot of questions for you. This kid's gonna test my will. I got a lot to learn and my baby's due.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike. Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.